Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's my particular pleasure to welcome back to the school the Governor, Mr. Eddie George, to deliver the fourth Bank of England lecture entitled How the Pieces Fit Together. And I'm delighted to see so many who share with me a fascination for hearing how indeed they do fit together. This is, as I said, the fourth Bank of England lecture. The first was given by the then Governor, Robin Lee Pemberton. He was followed by Mr. George, who was then Deputy Governor. And we've obviously fallen into a pattern, because every other one is clearly given by Mr. Eddie George. Let's hope that that continues. The Governor, who I think doesn't need any introduction to this audience by me. He's had a distinguished career, including in the early days, secondment to Moscow, a very far-sighted secondment. So he speaks Russian, amongst many other attributes. And those of our Russian students who would like to ask him a question in Russian, I'm sure he'd like to show off. The Governor has said that he would be prepared, or he expects to speak for 45 minutes, leaving 20 minutes or so for questions. Could I, though, ask those who do want to ask questions after the lecture to bear with us? Because, Eddie, although there are a large number of people whom you see arrayed before you who are eagerly awaiting to hear your lecture, this is actually only half the number. There is a video link to another lecture hall, which I'm told is equally full. And so we'll have to be a little bit careful when we come to question time to make sure that they out there, whom we can't see, will be able both to hear the questions and to hear the answers. But I'm running ahead of myself. Now it's my very pleasant duty to invite the Governor, Mr. Eddie George, to tell us how the pieces fit together at the Bank of England.
Well, thank you, John, I think, for that introduction. I think from the size of the audience, and I'm terrified to think that there are people in another room in the same number, I think you must have advertised this lecture after our last year as putting the pieces back together again. But it isn't, in fact, the title of the lecture, and you gave it out correctly. This is, in fact, the fourth and the last in the series of LSE Bank of England lectures. My predecessor as Governor, Lord Kingsdown, began the series by making the case for price stability as the immediate objective of monetary policy. In my own earlier lecture, I spoke about the pursuit of financial stability, describing our oversight of the financial system and our role as lender of last resort to the banking system. And in the third lecture, just over a year ago, the former Deputy Governor, Rupert Pennant-Ray, spoke about the international context within which we endeavour to achieve these fundamental twin objectives of monetary and financial stability. Now, I suppose that if you'd invited any major central bank to deliver these lectures, it's quite likely that they would have chosen to speak on these three topics. And while there would have certainly have been important national differences of detail, it's very likely, too, that the substance of what they would have said would have been much the same. The pursuit, nationally and internationally, of monetary and financial stability is the essential raison d'etre of central banks everywhere. And there is nowadays a broad consensus, both across countries and within countries across much of the political spectrum, about what that involves. But once you go beyond the level of generality that implies, each central bank is unique in terms of its constitutional position, the range of its activities, its size, its structure, its organization, and so on. So in this final lecture in the series, I should like to talk quite specifically about the Bank of England, discussing the institution as a whole and how the different pieces fit together. It's one of the intriguing things about the bank that its current statute, the Bank of England Act, which brought the bank into public ownership in 1946, makes no mention whatsoever of the bank's role or of the purposes for which it exists. The Act explicitly defines the constitutional relationship between the bank and the government, providing that the Treasury may from time to time give such directions to the bank as, after consultation with the governor, they think necessary in the public interest, subject to which the affairs of the bank shall be managed by the Court of Directors. The Act also empowers the bank, if they think it necessary in the public interest, to request information from and make recommendations to bankers, and it may, if so authorized by the Treasury, issue directions to any banker. Now, the bank's 1946 charter goes into considerable detail on the conduct of the court, even fixing the remuneration of directors in respect of their services on the court at the princely sum of £500 a year. And it describes the circumstances in which a governor, deputy governor or director shall vacate his office, including, incidentally, if he be found lunatic or become of unsound mind. But for reasons that are explained in John Ford's admirable history of the Bank of England and public policy from 1941 to 1958, and in contrast to other cases where central banks were set up ab initio, it was not felt necessary in this country either to define in statute the central bank's duties and responsibilities or to specify the purposes for which its powers were to be used, because in John Ford's phrase, the central bank was there already, the evolutionary product of growth over time. Now, the bank's role has continued to evolve over the 50 years within the flexible framework of the 1946 Act. It has, of course, adapted to changes in government policy, including in particular the progressive movement away from intervention and direct forms of control in many areas of the bank's activity. And it's had to respond to external changes in the economic and financial environment. But the essential substance of its role hasn't greatly altered. Some 5 years ago, we decided with our Court of Directors as the basis for our internal management framework to define our core purposes in what is in effect a mission statement, and I should like, if I may, to quote from it in its present form. It begins with the general statement that as the Central Bank of the United Kingdom, we are committed to promoting the public good by maintaining a stable and efficient monetary framework as our contribution to a healthy economy. And in pursuing that goal, we identify three core purposes: maintaining the integrity and the value of the currency, maintaining the stability of the financial system, both domestic and international, and seeking to ensure the effectiveness of the United Kingdom's financial services. The first two of these purposes you'll recognize at this level of generality as the essential purposes of all central banks. The third, concerning the effectiveness of the UK's financial services, is more unusual and perhaps peculiar to the Bank of England, which has a long-established tradition of encouraging the financial services industry in this country to meet the needs of the wider economy, both domestically and as the world's major international financial centre. I'll come back to that in talking about each of the core purposes in turn. Let me begin then with the integrity and value of the currency. In elaborating our monetary stability purpose, our statement goes on. Above all, it says, this involves securing price stability as a precondition for achieving the wider economic goals of sustainable growth and employment. We pursue this core purpose by influencing decisions on interest rates on the basis of economic and financial analysis of developments both at home and abroad, by participating in international discussions to promote the health of the world economy, by implementing agreed policy through our market operations and our dealings with the financial system, and by maintaining confidence in the note issue. I want to make two comments arising out of that about why we place so much emphasis on monetary stability and about the activities we undertake in pursuing it. I'm very well aware that some people still think that the bank sees price stability as an end in itself, to be pursued without regard to the implications for the truly good things in economic life, like the growth of activity and employment and increasing welfare. Now, there is a sense in which we do see price stability as an end in itself, as I hope you all would if you were responsible for issuing some £20 billion worth of promises to pay in the form of banknotes for a fixed nominal amount, which may be worth very much less in real terms by the time that they're presented. Honest money is desirable in its own right, and it helps to ensure transparency in the relationship between borrowers and lenders. But more fundamentally, the reason we are committed to price stability is not as an end in itself, but because we see it as a means to the end of precisely those good things of life which our critics assume we disregard. Implicit in their criticism is the notion that the aims of price stability and economic growth are necessarily in conflict with each other. Our conviction, based on the repeated experience of the past 50 years, is that such conflict is illusory in anything other than the short term. Time and again, we've seen attempts to stimulate the economy directly result in a relatively short period of faster economic growth, followed by recession, brought on by the policy restraint, which was eventually unavoidable to bring increasing economic imbalance and accelerating inflation back under control. We therefore see permanent price stability as a necessary condition for achieving steadier, sustainable growth into the medium and long term. It can also contribute indirectly to increasing the sustainable rate of growth, improving the efficiency of the economy by enabling economic decisions of all kinds to be based on real considerations rather than on speculation on the outcome for inflation, and by enabling relative price movements to transmit more meaningful signals about resource allocation, which are otherwise masked by erratic changes in the general level of prices. Now, that essentially is the case for price stability, the case for sound money, which was developed by Lord Kingsdown in his initial lecture. The point I'd emphasize this evening is the relevance of price stability and related economic stability in a much broader sense to our other core purposes, financial stability and the effectiveness of our financial services in meeting the needs of the wider economy. The link from monetary stability to financial stability is very clear, and it was touched upon in my own earlier lecture. Monetary instability and the volatility in financial markets which it engenders are probably the most serious of all the various types of risk that banks and other lenders or investors have to cope with. If you look around the world, almost every case where there's been a serious threat of systemic financial disturbance, and there have been a number in the last few years, can be traced back to macroeconomic policy failures of one kind or another. Monetary instability leaves financial institutions generally vulnerable to abrupt shifts in the creditworthiness of borrowers or other sudden changes in asset values that are extraordinarily difficult to predict or to insure against. Monetary stability is therefore fundamentally important to financial stability as well as to the long-run performance of the economy. But monetary stability contributes too to our third core purpose, the effectiveness of the financial system, going beyond the reduction of financial risk. One of the most frequent criticisms one hears about financial institutions in this country is that they take an excessively short-term approach to lending and investment. That's sometimes put down to our particular institutional structure. What's clear in that debate is that high and variable inflation and the economic instability that it reflects would tend to engender short-term attitudes regardless of the institutional structure. Longer-term lending would be deterred, for example, by the uncertainty premium that would necessarily be included in long-term interest rates, and long-term rates would also incorporate an element of compensation for the expected erosion of the real value of the loan capital, effectively representing early capital repayment. Given their past experience, even nominally short-term lenders will tend where they can to recall their loans at the first sign of downturn while there's value left in their borrowers. And more generally, it would be entirely rational in an unstable environment for investors, whether in real or financial assets, to look for a rapid payback rather than to the longer term. I don't claim that instability is necessarily the whole story. There may well be other factors. But our history of monetary instability must be an important influence on the behavior of our financial institutions, or for that matter, on the behavior of the boards of our industrial and commercial companies, especially their finance directors. To this extent, greater monetary stability can deliver not just a double, but a triple whammy. The case for permanently low inflation as a necessary condition for achieving steadier and more sustainable growth has gained increasing acceptance in this country over the past 20-odd years. This is reflected in the political decision by the government to set an explicit inflation target of 2.5% or less for the indefinite future. And the Labour Party, too, has committed itself to setting a low inflation target, if it comes to power, as the immediate objective of monetary policy. Given that political decision, the process of monetary policy formulation is essentially a technical one. The bank's role is to provide technical advice on the policy, and in particular on the short-term interest rate, that it considers necessary to achieve that inflation objective. Decisions about monetary policy remain for the Chancellor, consistently with the 1946 Bank of England Act. That process, I should say, is now uniquely transparent, and that's given rise to a certain amount of public interest and debate. That's a subject for another occasion. What matters in the end is the results in terms of our performance on inflation, but also on growth and employment. And all I'd say to you this evening is that we've made steady progress in all these respects, over the past 3 years or so, and the prospects remain very encouraging. The bank is also responsible for the implementation of monetary policy decisions through its operations, primarily in the money market, but also as agent for the government in the gilt-edged and the foreign exchange markets. For the most part, these activities and the other banking services which the bank provides to the government are uncontroversial, though there is, quite rightly, constant pressure to ensure that they are performed efficiently. Questions are sometimes raised about the bank's role in managing the government's borrowing, which some people argue is not a necessary central banking function and may somehow conflict with the operation of monetary policy. And it's true that, like a number of other activities that the bank undertakes, government debt management could, in principle, be organized in other ways. But there's no possibility for conflict that I can see in this context in this country. The bank undertakes the government's funding program as agent for the government on the basis of a mandate which we receive from the Treasury and which is drawn up essentially independently of the monetary policy process, but with the explicit objective of avoiding recourse to monetary financing, that's to say, short-term finance from the banking system, year by year. The essential substance of that mandate is regularly published, as is the outcome, and the bulk of the funding is raised through auctions in the bond markets to a timetable and in amounts that are signalled well in advance. As with the process of monetary policy formulation, the whole process of government debt management is nowadays almost wholly transparent. From the bank's point of view, our day-to-day involvement in all the main financial markets is an invaluable source of information and intelligence and enables us to develop an expertise which are invaluable to us in pursuing all three of our core purposes. In the monetary policy context, understanding market expectations and perceptions, understanding market developments, is an important complement to our economic analysis in formulating our policy advice. It's equally important to us in detecting, understanding, and responding to disturbances that may impact on the stability of the financial system. And it enables us to understand at first hand developments that may affect the users of financial markets, helping us to be better attuned to their concerns. In this respect, our activities, as well as our purposes, are mutually reinforcing and relevant to the work of the bank as a whole. Let me move on then to our second core purpose, maintaining the stability of the financial system, which in terms of our mission statement, we elaborate by saying that we seek to achieve this objective through supervising individual institutions and markets, through monitoring the links between financial markets, through analyzing the health of the domestic and international economy, through cooperation with other financial supervisors, both nationally and internationally, and through promoting sound and efficient payment and settlement arrangements. In exceptional circumstances, the bank may also provide or organize last resort financial support where this is needed to avoid systemic damage. Now, our central banking interest in financial stability is clear. If monetary instability is a potent source of disruption of the financial system, then it's equally the case that general instability originating in the financial system can complicate, even disrupt, our pursuit of monetary stability. It's because of this externality, the potential damage to the economy as a whole, going beyond the effect on any particular institution, that all central banks would recognize the twin objectives of monetary and financial stability in the sense of the stability of the financial system as a whole. And it's that same externality that justifies the setting of minimum prudential standards for systemic reasons, as well as our lender of last resort role. Now, even this is not uncontroversial. Some people argue here, too, that there's a potential conflict between the pursuit of monetary stability and concern with financial stability, such that if these responsibilities are combined in a single institution, then monetary policy punches may be pulled at times for fear of the financial instability that they might otherwise create. I can certainly envisage circumstances in which financial fragility is a constraint on monetary policy. It was no doubt a factor, though not an overriding factor, in the United States 3 or 4 years ago, for example. And it's a factor now in Japan. But you can't avoid the potential tension just by distinguishing institutionally the two responsibilities. Whoever was responsible for monetary policy in a situation of tension would have to take account of the financial fragility and vice versa, regardless of the institutional structure. More fundamental questions, or so it seems to me, concerning the extent and nature of the central banking responsibility in relation to the financial system arise from the rapid evolution of the global financial marketplace on the one hand, and from increasing public policy interest in quite different aspects of the behavior of financial institutions on the other. Historically, central banking grew largely out of concern for the stability of the financial system, and in particular the banking system, because it was there that systemic risks, the risks of contagion, were concentrated. More recently, the traditional distinctions between different types of financial institution, including banks, have become increasingly blurred. Under the impact of competition and of innovation of financial products and techniques, made possible by changes in technology and the move away from direct financial controls. At the same time, financial service businesses of all kinds have become increasingly international in their scope, with London the host to financial institutions from all parts of the world, and British institutions established in an increasing variety of traditional and emerging overseas financial markets. Together, these market developments have contributed to the rapid expansion of financial market transactions, through which intermediaries of all kinds assume exposures to each other, increasing the possibility for shocks originating in one part of the global financial marketplace to be transmitted elsewhere. Meanwhile, to varying degrees in different countries, the public policy interest in the behavior of financial institutions has spread well beyond just an interest in the stability of the financial system as a whole. It extends, for example, to an interest in the financial stability of individual institutions for reasons of depositor or investor or policyholder or pensioner protection. It extends to many areas of business conduct in order to protect users of financial services, especially less financially sophisticated retail users, from abuse of various kinds, ranging from outright deception to failure to give best advice or best execution, and involving varying degrees of intervention in the relationship between financial institutions and their individual clients. And it extends, too, to the protection of society more broadly against the use of the financial system to launder drug monies or the proceeds of other organized crime. Now, taken together, these developments raise a number of extraordinarily difficult questions, not just in this country, but in all countries individually, and also at the international level. A fundamental question is where to strike the balance between the undoubted benefits that flow from competition, including global competition in financial services, in terms of financial resource allocation, as well as for individual users of financial services, and the various social concerns that I've just identified that argue for public intervention. Although most people would probably accept that some regulation can contribute to the competitive efficiency of financial services by helping, for example, to retain the confidence of potential users of those services, there is, as in relation to many other forms of social intervention, plenty of room to debate the appropriate forms and degrees of financial regulation and the point at which it starts to interfere with the competitive efficiency or effectiveness of the financial system as a whole. The complaint that we are over-regulated meets the counter-complaint that we are under-protected, often, unfortunately, accompanied by the complaint that services are too expensive or insufficiently available on an adequately competitive basis. The essentially political trade-offs in this area are especially difficult to determine because they are so much a matter of degree on either side, and that, it seems, is impossible to define with any precision. The other very difficult issue, assuming that we do know just what it is we're trying to achieve, is how we can best organize ourselves institutionally in terms of the supervisory regulatory structure. Should that structure be based, for example, upon the type of financial institution, or on the type of activity, or on the type of user, or on the particular social purpose that's being pursued? It's clear from the diversity of structures across countries that there is no single model, and any model would need to adapt as the market and as public policy interests change. It's tempting to think that all of these problems could be resolved by sweeping everything together into a single financial services regulator. Though I'm bound to say that this approach seems to me seriously to underestimate the three-dimensional complexity of the issues. But whatever structure we have, there will be a need for clear definition and understanding of the responsibilities of the different institutional elements in the structure, or the different interests within a single institution, and intensive cooperation between them, both domestically and internationally. It's a difficult, ongoing agenda which will take a long time to work through. As it is, the Bank of England is responsible for the authorization and supervision of banks under separate legislation, the Banking Act of 1987. This responsibility to provide substantial, though not absolute, and that's a very good example of the imprecision of these terms, this responsibility to provide substantial protection for depositors in individual banks, in fact, fits comfortably alongside our traditional responsibility for the stability of the financial system as a whole. Notwithstanding the market developments that I've described, banks do still have distinctive characteristics giving them a key role in the financial system. Their balance sheets are still typically dominated by liquid liabilities on the one side and longer-term, predominantly non-marketable assets on the other, making them especially vulnerable to liquidity pressures as a result of a sudden loss of confidence on the part of their depositors. And banks, at least in this country, still have a unique role in the payments and therefore the settlement systems. Supervising each individual bank, therefore, equally helps us to monitor potential threats to institutions that are still, in this sense, at the heart of the financial system as a whole. And when preventative supervision fails, as it will inevitably from time to time, it puts us in a better position than we might otherwise be to assess whether a failure would create unmanageable difficulties for other financial institutions, and so to assess the case for lender of last resort assistance or for seeking other solutions. Now, of course, I accept that this is not the only possible arrangement. It does, nevertheless, in my view, have very considerable advantages of informational and operational synergy in relation to our concern with the stability of the financial system as a whole. And our continuous monitoring of individual bank behavior can also provide insights and better understanding of the monetary influences on the macroeconomy, which are very helpful in relation to our monetary stability purpose. And these advantages would need to be weighed against the perceived advantages of alternative supervisory regulatory structures. Whatever view one takes of those particular issues, two things seem to me to be very clear. First, that any central bank must monitor developments in the banking system very closely, and that will necessarily involve monitoring what is happening in individual banks. And secondly, a central bank can't, in the modern world, limit its view of developments to the banking system alone. Because systemic threats can originate in other parts of the financial system, and because of the speed with which they can be transmitted through the system, we must necessarily take a very close interest in the financial sector as a whole. This underpins our concern with financial stability, but it's the foundation, too, of our third core purpose, to which I now finally turn. This third core purpose we describe to ourselves as seeking to ensure the effectiveness of the UK's financial services. And we elaborate this as wanting a financial system that offers opportunities for firms of all sizes to have access to capital on terms that give adequate protection to investors and which enhance the international competitive position of the City of London and other UK financial centres. We aim to achieve these goals through our expertise in the marketplace, by acting as a catalyst to collective action where market forces alone are deficient, by supporting the development of a financial infrastructure that furthers these goals, by advising government, and by encouraging British interests through our contacts with other financial authorities overseas. Now, I want to be clear, we don't mean by this that the bank has, or thinks it ought to have, some sort of blueprint or dirigiste master plan for the way in which financial services should develop in this country. That properly is for the market to determine through the interaction of competing institutions seeking to meet the evolving needs of financial services users. But there are situations in which there would be benefits to the community as a whole from collective initiatives, but where the market on its own finds it difficult to act because of the conflicting interests of the individual market participants. And it's in these situations where the bank can play a useful role. We have no formal locus in this area. We rely upon collective consent. But we do have a long and valid tradition of involvement as a facilitator. And that tradition survives even in today's increasingly competitive environment in which financial services have increasingly become governed by statute. And we are, both through the information, the expertise, and the contacts that we acquire in pursuing our other core purposes, and through our unique position somewhere between the central government and the rest of the economy, we are uniquely well placed to play a constructive role. What's more, this role helpfully complements and supports the rest of what we do. Let me try and explain how by giving you some examples of what it involves. The key questions, I suppose, are why we unusually, as I say, among our peer central banks, see this as a core part of our role, and just what does it involve? The case for the bank's involvement is perhaps most obvious and effective when it flows directly from our other core activities. It was, for example, entirely natural and directly relevant that we should join with the banks and the stock exchange at the time of Big Bang to develop assured book entry settlement arrangements for the gilt-edged market in which we ourselves are a major player, the Central Gilts Office. It was equally relevant that when the London Clear project for money market settlements or the Taurus project for equity settlements stalled, we should accept mandates from the market to develop appropriate systems in these cases too. Somewhat further removed from our own direct concerns, we took a close and benevolent interest in the market's successful attempts to set up a financial futures exchange here in London, and we also played a matchmaking role in the subsequent merger of Life and the LTOM, the London Traded Options Markets. Now we are supporting the stock exchange in their current efforts to reform the equity market structure. In all of these examples, and there are many others, by contributing what we can to the effectiveness of markets, in the first instance as an end in itself for the users of those markets, we are able also to reduce the risks in the financial system through safer settlement and increased liquidity, for example. And we improve our understanding of the relevant activities, which contributes particularly to our ability to identify and manage systemic risks that may arise in these areas. Further along the spectrum, the bank has, over a long period, encouraged the financial sector to identify areas in which its support for the wider economy could be improved. Through the founding of what is now 3i, for example, we contributed to the provision of venture capital to smaller companies. And we have more recently been very active in promoting a better understanding between the providers of finance of all kinds and the small business sector, not least because of the important part that small business can play in increasing employment. We also, for example, contribute to the development of the private finance initiative. Through this kind of activity, and again drawing on our broader understanding of the financial system, we are able to play a constructive part in improving the structural context within which monetary policy has to operate, and that completes the circle. Mr. Chairman, I've tried in this concluding lecture to provide you with a more rounded view of the Bank of England as an institution, covering all three of our core purposes rather than focusing on any one of them. There are, of course, all kinds of ways to skin any cat, but we believe that taken together, our activities make a coherent whole, that the three core objectives complement and reinforce each other, and that there is a synergy of information, contacts and relationships, and expertise and experience which makes it efficient to pursue those objectives together. I hope that I've persuaded you that the pieces do indeed fit together. Perhaps, Mr. Chairman, I might conclude by saying how delighted the Bank of England has been to be associated with the LSE through this series of lectures. You have recently celebrated your centenary on which I congratulate you. Over that 100 years, you have made a very major contribution to thinking about central banking and the role that central banks can play. I hope that through this series of lectures, we at the Bank of England may have helped to sustain your interest in central banking and strengthen the excellent relationship that has long existed between our two institutions. Thank you very much indeed.
As I said when introducing the governor, there is now time for questions for those who would like to ask some. But it is going to be just a little tricky because of the existence of that unseen audience at the other end of the video link. We do have some microphones, I think, on the ground floor. Do we have any mics on the gallery? No? So what I'd like to do is to take questions alternately from the floor and from the gallery, and since there are no microphones upstairs, if you'll bear with me, I'll repeat the questions from the gallery through this microphone, because this has a link to the new theatre.
So I hope you'll repeat the questions in Russian, Mr.
Oh, chance will be a fine thing. But I think, can we start with questions down here? Yes, sir. You at the back. Could you just... Yes. Could you get a mic, please?
Do you think that the Bank of England... Do you think that...
No, you... Sorry. Could you switch it on?
Is that any better?
Yep, that's lovely.
Do you think that the Bank of England should enjoy the same degree of independence as that enjoyed by, for example, the Bundesbank or the Federal Reserve or, for sake of argument, the Bank of New Zealand?
Thank you. I mean, I've been very consistent on this. I don't campaign for independence for the central bank. What I campaign remorselessly for is monetary stability. We have moved to a situation where the Bank of England is encouraged, indeed required, to make its advice to the Chancellor, who takes the decision, public. We have moved to a situation, of course, where, as I said in my lecture, we have a clear inflation objective. I think I'm very happy for the time being with those arrangements. I think over time, one of the things that we will learn from those arrangements is whether there is indeed a consistent bias in the perceptions from the central banking standpoint and from the political standpoint, and whether that bias is justified in terms of the outcome. I think then there may well be a case for considering moving in the direction of operational autonomy. But for the time being, I'm very happy for us to continue with what I think is an extremely exciting experiment.
Now, any questions from the gallery? Oh, yes. So there's a microphone just coming your way.
Yes, thank you. Do you think a central banker should react to a booming real estate market when we see the current experience of Japan?
Yes, I do think that one of the things that you should pay very close attention to in looking at the monetary and economic situation is what's happening to asset prices generally. And certainly I would include property prices, both residential and commercial property prices, within the scope of that consideration. I don't think that you should respond in a kind of automatic way to movements in any indicator. I think the absolute essence of the task is actually looking at all the information that's available to you. But I do think that there have been a number of situations where I think property prices were quite a good signal to the fact that things were going to happen in the economy, which would actually put stability at risk.
No. The lady at the back.
May I ask you two questions. First of all, do you think the most recent rate cut was premature? And secondly, do you think the economy is growing well below trend like the Chancellor does?
We took a decision when we introduced these arrangements, which are just about the most transparent that you have anywhere. We took a decision that in general principle we would not actually announce what happened at the meetings immediately. And let me explain the reason for that. The reason for that is that you're very often dealing with situations which are not complete in themselves. They're ongoing situations, very often involving uncertainties in financial markets. I think if we were regularly to announce the nature of our discussions, the positions that we've taken, then that could actually contribute to instability in financial markets rather than helping it. And that's the decision that we've taken, and that's the principle which we try to stick to. Now, occasionally, when there are very major changes, where there were, for example, last May was an extremely strong market expectation that we would raise rates, where we decided not to raise rates, then it was appropriate to actually explain that we decided not to raise rates, and then inevitably you had to say something about what had happened in the meeting. Again, at the meeting when we did agree to lower rates in December, that was the first downward move for some considerable time. On past experience, there would have been an expectation that a 0.25% reduction was a kind of horse trade, and we were very anxious to allow the market to know that that wasn't in fact the case. Now, a lot of people have speculated about what happened at this latest meeting when we lowered rates again. We have agreed that we would not actually discuss which side of the argument I was on, or indeed give any other clue to what was going on, because if we do it again now, when there's no particular reason why we should, we will simply get into the business of effectively doing the thing in real time. And we still think that the reasons why we decided not to do that in the first place are valid. Now, that's a very long way of saying I'm sorry I can't answer that part of your question. Do I think that the economy is running well below trend as the Chancellor does? Well, the answer to that in the short term is yes. I think it's really fairly clear. We are not clever enough to know with any great precision what the trend rate of growth is in the economy, or what the sustainable rate of growth is in the economy. But the latest figures that we've had for GDP growth over the last three quarters have been 0.4% a quarter. Now, I think on anybody's reckoning, that is below the sustainable rate of growth in the economy. And I don't think anybody really thinks that we started from a situation where we were above capacity output in the economy. So I certainly agree with that. I also think, which I think is the reason for the Chancellor making that remark, that we are seeing a far more a pause in continental Europe, which I think few people had expected to see, certainly hadn't expected it to see to this degree, and where there is a concern that it might continue for rather longer than one might have supposed, even when it began to appear. So for both those reasons, I do think that the economy is, for the time being, growing below capacity. I actually also happen to agree with the Chancellor that I think there's very positive reasons for thinking that domestic demand, particularly consumer demand, will accelerate through the course of the year if, as we're told, the slowdown in Europe is a temporary slowdown, a pause, then I think you'll see growth picking up through the course of this year.
Yes, sir. You're...
I know that the bank is fully involved with the European Monetary Institute in the planning for EMU and the formation of a European Central Bank. How do you envisage the Bank of England's relationship with that European Central Bank?
I mean, you're asking me, will we be in or out? And that's, I mean, because it will obviously be different if we're in or if we're out. And that decision, of course, is a political one. I think it's very straightforward. If we're in, we will be a member of the European Central Bank Council, one member among I don't know how many, and it will be that body, and that body alone, which takes decisions which are relevant to monetary policy. If, on the other hand, one's on the outside, one won't participate in that way. But I do think, nevertheless, that one will participate and cooperate actively with the European Central Bank Council, because I think, in or out, there is a clear interest in the pursuit of prudent, stability-oriented policies, particularly monetary policies, in order to establish the underlying stability which is essential to really get the greatest benefits from the single market. I think it's tremendously important that people should understand that the debate about ins and outs, certainly in relation to the UK's position, is not that I think anybody thinks that being out is a kind of license to behave in any imprudent or reckless kind of way. I fear some people see it in that light, but I have to say my own view is that the disciplines that will be imposed on the conduct of our policy will be at least as severe if we're on the outside as they will on the inside. I think the debate is about a completely different range of issues. So that in those circumstances, and provided that were true, then I would expect that we would have an extremely kind of constructive and harmonious relationship with the European Central Bank Council, if indeed we were on the outside.
Gentlemen down.
Does the Bank of England supervise European authorized institutions, specifically those which have branch offices in this country? And secondly, does the Bank of England provide a protective framework for the relationship between banks and their retail customers in this country? On the second aspect, do you have a position regarding would get involved with the oversight of the relationship between retail customers and their banking institutions?
I think there were a number of questions there, and I didn't quite manage to get them all down on my piece of paper. But the first question was very straightforward. Do we have a responsibility for supervising branches of European or European Union authorized banks in this country? And the answer is no. That I mean, the way in which that works is that under the banking coordination directives, there are common minimum standards, prudential standards, to be applied by all countries within Europe, whoever is actually doing the supervision. And that means that we are responsible for ensuring that British authorized banks with branches in Europe are actually observing those minimum prudential standards, and it means that a continental country has that same responsibility for their branches here. There are some exceptions to that, and in relation to the potential for criminal activity, well then of course we would have an interest. And of course, notwithstanding the allocation of responsibilities, we have an interest, so that we can cooperate within the framework of memoranda of understanding with the home country supervisor to the extent that we agree. But in principle, under the Banking Coordination Directive, the responsibility for prudential supervision lies with the home country supervisor, not with the host. You talked about the relationship between retail customers and banks in this country, and I'm not clear in what respect. We do, leaving aside the European dimension, we do have a responsibility in to actually supervise banks with the objective of reducing the risks that the bank will fail, and with the objective of providing, as I said in my talk, a degree of protection to individual depositors. Where a bank does fail, there is a deposit protection scheme which actually provides compensation to small depositors up to about £20,000. That has now been swept up in a European arrangement, but the essence of it hasn't changed. But you can be compensated for 90% of the first small amount and then 75% of the rest up to about £20,000. So there is that kind of responsibility, and that's incorporated within the Banking Act. But if you want to go further and say, do we have a responsibility for the relationship between retail customers and banks in the sense of whether the retail customer is getting a good deal or whether the bank is treating him fairly, then we don't have a responsibility directly in that context under the Banking Act. That in this country is done under a code of conduct which has been agreed among the banks and which is overseen by the Banking Ombudsman, which is quite separate and independent of the Bank of England. Now, a lot of people think that because we have a responsibility for satisfying ourselves that the management of banks are fit and proper to manage banks, that we should then look at every incident where there's a commercial conflict between retail customers or business because they believe that there's evidence of wrongdoing of some form or even unethical behaviour, which would be relevant to our consideration of fitness and properness. Most of those cases, of course, are disputed, and those are a matter ultimately for the law if they can't be resolved through this ombudsman system. If the law continuously finds, repeatedly finds, or even on a sufficient scale, in a few cases finds, that the bank is behaving in an improper way, then of course that will become a consideration for us in a fitness and properness case. But we can't put ourselves, we have no locus or authority to put ourselves in the place of the courts in involving commercial disputes between banks and their customers.
I wonder if you could just restrict yourself to one question. Yes. Go on. Talk. And the question is, what are the lessons from BCCI and Barings? And how have they been incorporated into the oversight mechanisms of the Bank of England? Okay, if you could pass it back, we might try and switch it on. Right.
I mean, of course, we learnt a great many lessons, I think, from both of those episodes. Not just us, but I think, a lot of other people involved, both on the regulatory side and otherwise. If you pin me down to what precisely were the lessons, the major lessons, I would say the major lesson in the case of BCCI was that it was the first time that we, or I think anybody else, had come across where there was evidence of impropriety at the very top of the bank. I mean, by and large, in general, one assumes that if there's going to be misrepresentation, if there's going to be fraud, then it's going to be at lower levels in banking institutions, and that sadly does happen from time to time, and we've all had experience of that. But this was, for the first time, a case where the actual management of the bank were manipulating, were misrepresenting, and that created a problem of its own. The full investigation of that, the Bingham report, which I have to tell you I thought was absolutely magnificently done, said that I think that was the real main lesson, that the basis of trust on which we basically conduct banking supervision in this country had served the country well. That was his term, but I can't remember the precise language, but he said we had to be more sensitive to situations where that basis of trust may have broken down. I think of all the lessons we learned from BCCI, that was the one that was most important. In the Barings case, the Board of Banking Supervision report on Barings made 17 recommendations to the Bank of England, and we are pursuing them all, and I've just reported back to the board what we've actually done in response to their 17 recommendations, and I've sent a copy of that report to the Treasury Committee, who are obviously also extremely interested. If I could break that down into, I think, really two things which seem to me to be hugely important coming out of the Barings case. The first is very much an internal lesson from us. The board recommended that we should have a quality assurance function in the bank to make sure that the way in which we conducted supervision, the skills that we brought to bear in supervision, were even across the function. And so we've actually commissioned an outside investigation by Arthur Anderson to help us to develop that quality assurance function. And I think that will be tremendously useful to us. I think it'll be extremely welcome to the supervisors themselves, because it is actually quite a lonely thing when you're responsible for a raft of banks to be sure that you're actually pursuing the right thing. So internally, I think that's the major lesson. Externally, I think the major lesson is to do with cooperation between regulators, the sort of thing that I was talking about in my lecture, particularly between regulators internationally. This is a huge task because although I think the cooperation has developed very well among the major banking supervisors, the other dimensions of it, relations between banking supervisors and other financial regulators at home and abroad, with financial services regulators, with market regulators, that is a network, so that we get to a situation where there is the habit of communication. I think that's the other main lesson I derive from Barings. But the Barings report from the Board of Banking Supervision will give you 17 lessons which you can look at.
I think just time for three questions if we can fit them in. The first one from the gentleman in the green shirt at the back.
Aaron Muslin from European BID. Become a competitor to the dollar as an international reserve currency? And if so, would a relaxation of the rules for joining the EMU hamper this or make this less likely?
Yes and yes, I think, are the answers.
Good.
To those two Blended. Questions.
Nick, up the top there.
I mean, no, that's not fair. I mean, it clearly could, just in the way that the sterling was an alternative to the dollar as an international currency. Sterling's tended to go down, the Deutschmark has risen. Now, the reason why that's happened is because, of course, the Deutschmark has been a more stable currency. I mean, it's had attractions of that sort. And if the euro were to prove to be stable in the sense that the Deutsche Mark has been, then I'm sure it would emerge as an internationally used currency. The reason why I say yes to the second question is that I think that's very unlikely unless we're very insistent that the economic conditions are satisfied and we don't get carried away by the political aspiration. People may see that as news in the current context, but I have to tell you I've been saying that for a very long time and I will keep on saying it.
Right. Back then.
Mr. Governor, as you know that the New Zealand Parliament passed an act which offered the governor of the central bank an incentive contract. That means, well, if the inflation goes up by 1%, his salary or the will be cut by 5% or so. How effective, do you think such a contract would change the behavior or the policy contract of the central bank? And also, had you been offered such a contract, do you think would you conduct monetary policy differently?
The answer to the second part of your question is no and no. I mean, seriously, on this subject of contract, I don't believe that it's fundamental to the issues that we're talking about. If I were offered it, and if the price were that I got operational control over the interest rate, although, as I say, I don't campaign for that, I would accept it like a shot. I don't believe it would actually make any difference to what I, the approach that I took to monetary policy, but it would mean that I could follow my own advice and account for it in terms of the outcome rather than the situation that we have at the moment. Of course, if I'm not able to do that, then I'm not going to accept that contract. But I really think there's too much emphasis has been put on this particular piece of mechanics. I think if you're as committed to the job as any central bank governor that I know, then you don't have to have this kind of financial incentive. But if people want to make it, then that's okay with me.
Last question, though, to the... yes. But behind you, on the next to the gentleman in the green shirt.
I understand there's now agreement on the main monetary policy tools that will be used by a future European Central Bank. The tools are remarkably similar to those currently used by the Bundesbank. I just wonder, would the Bank of England be happy to take part in such a system which could possibly include minimum reserve requirements?
I don't know who's told you there's agreement on the policy instruments. But I can tell you for one, there's one person who doesn't agree, but I think actually it's more than that. What we are agreed upon is that, the objective is laid down in the statute of the European Central Bank. So there's no dispute. We have an explicit objective of achieving price stability to a stronger form than is actually in the Bundesbank statute, I think. There is a debate about the role of monetary targets. I think that's a very much hyped up kind of debate, because until we've actually got some data, we don't know as an empirical matter whether the relationship between the monetary aggregates on the European Monetary Union area basis and activity and prices, nominal income and inflation, whether that relationship is robust or flopping all over the place. So I think what we would all agree upon in the EMI is that we would have to monitor, analyze monetary developments, I mean collect the data, and pay very close attention to those, whether we used it as a kind of help to analysis in a general sense or placed more emphasis on it as a specific target. I frankly think that the distinction between those positions is not huge. So I don't actually foresee any great difficulty in finding a modus vivendi on the objective and the target setting. On the actual instruments, we are agreed that the basic structure would require a lending rate to the market, to the banking system, which would be something like the German Lombard rate, but we all have it when the market's short of liquidity and the central banks are needed to provide the banking system with liquidity, then we would have such a lending facility. We would also, in a European situation, I think want to have a floor facility, that's to say a deposit facility, at which when the banking system was long of liquidity, it could deposit surplus liquidity with the central bank, so that you get a kind of corridor which encapsulates market rates, which would be somewhere in between. Within that corridor, we're all agreed that you would basically use open market operations in one form or another, not hugely important, to actually steer the interest rate, and we have to define a particular interest rate within that market corridor. Now, all of that, again, I think you would find was very broadly agreed within the ECB. Where there's disagreement is whether we should have reserve requirements on the one hand and a subsidized discount facility, the subsidized lending facility, a discount facility which was rationed by quotas on the other. And that question is being very actively debated, and I think that debate will go on for a long time. I think from our perspective, given the things I've said we're agreed upon, I don't see any monetary reason, monetary policy reason, for having either of those two accessories, if you like. I think that they're very much related to Germany's institutional arrangements, whereby the discount facility is particularly important in relation to a lot of the smaller banks, and they have a lot of very small banks in Germany. And I think the reserve requirement is effectively a means, too, of producing and perhaps redistributing income within the German system. I'm open to persuasion, but I see those as the reasons. The very big disadvantage I see for both those instruments in the context of Europe is that they distort the markets to a degree which I think would actually impose competitive risks for European banks in relation to European non-banks and for European banks in relation to banks internationally. And I will want to be very clearly persuaded of the monetary purpose of those accessories, as I've called them, the reserve requirements and the discount, subsidized lending facility, before we can agree to going down that road.
Well, Eddie, I'd like to thank you on behalf not only of all those you see before you, but of that equal number that you can't see, that's the other side of the video link, for giving us a fascinating account of how the Bank of England, extraordinary institution, which is so much older, I might say, than the LSE, how this extraordinary institution currently fits together. And can I also thank you for dealing with the questions in such an open and frank way. It really is a great privilege for us to have you here again, and indeed a great pleasure. You mentioned how useful you saw it for us to collaborate in this way and provide this series of four public lectures, and I do think it is a very public way of demonstrating the close connections that there have grown up between the LSE and the bank. I well remember when I became director first, your chief economist came back to us. We always thought of him as our professor of economics, and Charles Goodhart was replaced. By Mervyn King. I have to say, we still think of Mervyn as one of our professors. and so not only is there this public collaboration, but there is a free and easy interchange between our professors of economics and your people too. And I think that is just as it should be. There needs to be a very close and understanding relationship between those academics who study and those practitioners who practice. And this series of lectures has been yet another illustration of the importance of that and the importance that we both place on it. So thank you very much, not only for the lecture that you've given us, but for helping us to put on this series, and indeed for the whole series considered as a whole. It has been a very suitable and very fitting ornament to our centennial year. Could I just ask and crave a further indulgence, if you wouldn't mind, if you could just hold back a bit as Eddie and I fight our way out to the lifts. We have to go to the senior dining room, which is on the fifth floor. So on behalf of us all, Eddie, thank you very much, and let's rush for the door.